what's going on, everybody. Alan Kenny, managing editor with CrystalBallRun.com, the Blogging Network's national college football blog. Big news today in the world of college football was the sanctions handed down on the University of Oregon, stemming from some of their dealings with we'll call him talent scout Will Liles. You know, a lot of the consensus seems to be that the Ducks got off pretty light, but I wanted to bring on the foremost NCAA jurisprudence expert, of course, John Infante of athleticscholarships.net. He also is the guy, the brains behind the Bylaw blog, which is an invaluable resource for anyone interested in understanding the NCAA and kind of the college sports model. So let's go ahead and bring him in. John, what's going on, man?
Not much. How are you?
Oh, doing very well, doing very well. So this is a ruling that people have been waiting on, I mean, for a very long time. You know, I mean, it's kind of the way these NCAA enforcement cases have kind of dragged out lately with, you know, Miami, USC, you know, Oregon's right up there. This took a long time to come down. A lot of people seem to think the Ducks got off pretty light. But what was your general reaction, you know, to what you saw, at least in the decision?
I would agree that they got off pretty light, especially if you consider what this case looked like when it was first reported, as you said, way back in March 2011, which is when Willie Liles first started talking to the NCAA and talking to Yahoo as well. I think if you had told people back then that this would end up with a couple scholarships, no bowl ban, and a show cause order that, had he been there, might have even still been survivable for Chip Kelly, I think most people would have been pretty surprised and seen it as the NCAA protecting, you know, yet another big program. But in this case, I think a lot has happened since the case first came to light that sort of will explain why, in the end, I think, you know, while the NCAA took, while the Committee on Infractions took a fairly lenient view of this, it doesn't say all that much about, you know, them not being tough on cheaters in the future.
Okay, well, can you explain that? I mean, what did come to light in the interim that you think led to that kind of, that outcome?
So this case, you know, originally centered around, and a lot of the attention was paid to, this $25,000 payment that Oregon made to Liles for use of his recruiting service, which it looks like was not much of a recruiting service until the Ducks realized they needed materials to justify the payment. That at the time was against NCAA rules, and those recruiting service rules had been put in place because, starting with men's basketball, it was discovered that they were essentially doing what it looked like Oregon was doing with Liles, that somebody with who was connected to prospects would have a recruiting service, which in some cases would be little more than cutting and pasting things from rivals or, you know, a list of kids with evaluations like high major or good player or good jump shot. And they would not let coaches talk to their prospects unless they or their boosters bought these recruiting services, or in some cases multiple copies of these recruiting services, and they would be somewhere on the order of thousands of dollars per year to subscribe to what was essentially, you know, information that anybody can get with a quick Google search. So the NCAA established regulations about what a recruiting service needed to do in order to be legitimate. And Liles was not, you know, in that year in 2010 that he, you know, received the $25,000 from Oregon, his service did not comply with those regulations. But in between when that violation came to light and when the decision came down, the NCAA changed the rules yet again and said, we're not going to put this on the schools to figure out which ones comply and which ones don't. We're just going to have a national registry. So now recruiting service operators must submit applications to the NCAA, and then if they comply with the same set of rules, they are approved. So there's really no need for a strong rule anymore, at least on the side of the schools, to make sure that they're not buying fake recruiting services that are just really payments to middlemen. if we assume, you know, that the NCAA is doing a good job vetting the recruiting services that they're approving. On top of that, more generally, on August 1st, we have a whole new enforcement program, you know, a whole new committee on infractions that's going to be expanded and include coaches and presidents and, you know, a wider range of people. We have a new enforcement structure, a new way that cases are going to be processed, and we have a brand new penalty matrix. Not to mention what might happen with the staff as it kind of rebuilds in the wake of the Miami scandal and some of the staff losses they've had. So we know a reset button is going to be pushed on August 1st, and we know that this rule that was kind of originally the center of the Oregon case is not even the current rule anymore, despite being only a couple of years old. So it was really, you know, kind of a lame duck group that was ruling on an old bylaw when everybody knew the game was going to kind of change in a little over a month anyway. So if it looks like they just kind of, you know, as I saw one columnist said, took a knee or just kind of, you know, shuffled this off their desk, I think that might be the case, especially when you consider that, you know, they've heard and now are trying to figure out what they're going to rule on the Miami case as well.
What a mess, though, then. I mean, you have, just based on the evidence that was given, they pretty blatantly kind of, if they didn't explicitly violate the rule, I mean, they clearly weren't really, I guess, complying with the spirit of it.
Well, I think it's the opposite of that, is that they weren't compliant with the letter of it, but the committee on infractions found that they weren't, or at least, you know, wasn't able to find that they didn't kind of violate what was the original spirit. And, you know, even the enforcement staff, because we saw with the summary disposition agreement, kind of agreed with Oregon that was really just a technical violation of the requirements of recruiting service. Even the enforcement staff was not ready to claim that Oregon, you know, to basically take that $25,000 payment for a service that doesn't meet the standards and turn it into, you know, a $25,000 payment in order to land prospects and essentially turn it into, you know, paying a middleman. And that's what the bylaw was originally intended to do. So, you know, and this kind of looked like a case where it was really teed up for the enforcement staff and the Committee on Infractions to send that message that, you know, we knew about this problem years ago in men's basketball. We expanded this rule to football and other sports. But again, when you think that what's happened since then, that's not the way this rule is structured anymore. It's not the way that they're attacking. And frankly, I think the, you know, the people who are trying to profit off of where kids go to school have moved on to the next scam and probably have already gotten tired of that one and moved on to the one after that while the NCAA is still trying to figure out what the, you know, still one step behind. So, you know, you can look at this as a case where I think the delay really contributed to Oregon's, you know, getting off lately. Because if this had come up in January 2012, which is when, or early 2012, when the investigation had finished, and if it had gone straight to the Committee on Infractions before we had a brand new enforcement program coming into effect, I think you may have seen a committee that needed or that felt more that it was more necessary to send that message and to make sure that there was a strong, you know, backing to the recruiting services rule. But they tried to go through summary disposition. It fell through, and that delay ended up costing, you know, essentially a whole year before the case could be brought in front of the Committee on Infractions.
I see what you're saying, but I guess now I'm thinking, you know, you mentioned guys that might be trying to profit off this, you know, moved on to the next scam. Well, I don't know. Now aren't they maybe looking at this decision, or the schools looking at this decision also, or, you know, a coach and saying, oh, well, let's just go back and keep doing this because the precedent is there now to where it doesn't feel like this is something that the NCAA really takes that seriously.
Well, remember, though, that the NCAA is now approving all the recruiting services. So, to go back to this one would mean you'd have to have, you know, you have to be able to slip one past the NCAA. And I think, you know, I think it's almost a thing where if you can get a national recruiting service that the NCAA will say is worth $25,000 through their approval process, you're probably not running the kind of profit margin off of that as you are off of Xeroxing, you know, somebody else's information and selling it, you know, as the legitimate product when you're really offering access to prospects. Mm-hmm. So again, I think that's, you know, goes back to this point where there really wasn't that much at stake here. It was really just, you know, whether or not Oregon was going to get a bowl ban, and it wasn't a case with the kind of broader implications that we might have seen with a case like USC or North Carolina or Miami coming up.
Okay, yeah, that's actually a really interesting angle that I hadn't considered. So, excuse me. So I think though, like in the broader context, I mean, can you understand? I guess maybe the general public seemed to kind of look at this and just and kind of shake their heads. They just didn't know what to make of it compared to some of the more stiff penalties that we've seen levied. I mean, I guess can you understand kind of the confusion that, you know, the NCAA might be dealing with in that regard?
Well, yeah, and I don't think it's any different than the confusion that they get when, you know, in comparing any of these cases. I think in this case, I think there's a place where you can look and say, I can understand why the Committee on Infractions ruled this way, and, you know, if you want to go into the sort of conspiracy theories that people have, you can even sort of justify it there, which is, you know, that the Committee on Infractions likes to send messages or it likes to protect programs. And in this case, you know, it wasn't, you know, I don't think people think of Oregon as being one of the program, you know, the blue blood programs that the NCAA couldn't possibly touch, although I would point to a number of instances this proves that over the last few years. But at the same time, you know, there's not really a message to be sent here. You know, make sure you comply with a bylaw that doesn't exist anymore under a system that's only going to be around for another month. So it really was just about, you know, what was the appropriate penalty for Oregon. And given even the enforcement staff's view of the case, I don't know if the committee, you know, could have come to a different conclusion, especially one that included, you know, much more significant penalties for Oregon, like a bowl ban. And even a bowl ban, I think we would have seen that appealed. I think Oregon would have gotten through this year without having to face that. And then, you know, we saw UCF overturn a bowl ban, so I wouldn't, you know, necessarily bet too hard against Oregon being able to do that if that had been the case.
Yeah, that's a fair point. So, you know, I guess, I don't know, are there any kind of bigger lessons to take from this in terms of how schools approach compliance, maybe?
I think, you know, the attitude we saw at Oregon was really good with this. You know, this was a school which, you know, 2 years ago, everybody was calling for, you know, bowl bans, death penalties, show causes, you know, every penalty in the book. And, you know, 2 years later, they come out of it relatively unscathed. And you don't see the school sort of patting itself on the back, kind of being defiant in the way that USC was, even when they had just received severe sanctions. And I think, you know, the thing that the Committee on Infractions wants to see, and that I think will continue to be the case even when you add former conference commissioners, former presidents, former coaches, and a wider range of people to that committee, is they want to see that you're taking this seriously. They want to see that you understand the gravity of the situation. And I think USC wasn't able to show that. I think, you know, some of the other cases, maybe, you know, Ohio State wasn't able to show that. And Oregon, it looks like, was, that they took this seriously, that they cooperated fully, that they, you know, maybe even went above and beyond in that cooperation, and they cooperated with the process. I mean, the only reason that we had a hearing in this case and it wasn't summary disposition was that Oregon refused to agree that the recruiting service violation was a major violation. Had they sort of just fallen on their sword there, they would have finished this case in December under summary disposition and probably ended up with the same penalties, maybe even a year less of probation. So I think that's the big lesson, is that when you get into one of these cases, while it's tempting to while it's increasingly tempting as this process has gotten more adversarial, and we're certainly going to see that with Miami, because they have good reason to be adversarial in this process. Yeah. But barring something like that, show that you're working with the NCAA. Show that you, even if you're denying the violations, that you understand that this is serious, and that you understand that you need to get to the bottom of things. And if there's a problem, you need to correct it, even if you don't think that problem rises to a major violation. And I think that's what Oregon did in this case. And I think when you do that, you get the enforcement staff more on your side. And, you know, it's just easier to go into the Committee on Infractions with, when you agree on more things and you have to answer fewer questions from them and fight on fewer points, you can pick your spots and get a more favorable result.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, to me, this all comes back to the fact that, you know, and I know we talked about this many times, the NCAA doesn't have subpoena power. And so, I mean, it is very much a self-monitoring, a system that relies on self-monitoring, kind of self-assessment. And, you know, to me, you know, you get a case like, for example, Bruce Pearl, who, you know, lied about something so stupid and got, you know, hammered for it, specifically because the NCAA, you know, the whole process relies on transparency and not lying about stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that every time it seems like a school gets off light, I mean, you've got to always keep in mind, to me, the incentive here that the NCAA, I mean, while there are punishments that they're handing out, I mean, the incentive is always going to be to reward people for complying and for, you know, like you said, kind of making an effort.
Right. And, you know, I think, the way the NCAA treats cooperation is a good example of that. So, we see, especially when a school kind of gets, kind of digs their heels in, you know, it looks like they're not cooperating. There's an obligation to cooperate. I mean, it's sort of said, you know, that schools cooperate in order to get off light, but it's more like, you know, they cooperate to kind of the first level, like the standard that's expected of them in order to avoid the stiffer penalties. The best example of a case like that is Georgia Tech a couple of years ago, who had a very minor eligibility violation that blew up into a major violation that caused them to lose a conference championship and end up on probation for 4 years, all because they tried to hide it. And then when the NCAA was investigating it, they interfered with the investigation. And, you think Bruce Pearl, you know, like you said, another example of failing to cooperate is not just, you know, making the NCAA's life difficult. It's more, you know, it really can turn a molehill into a mountain really quick. And then, you know, we sort of see what goes beyond that. And the cases are rare, and I can't even think of one off the top of my head, although I know there have been, you know, one or two in the past few years where the NCAA rewards really good cooperation. And the way they kind of put it is, the what's expected of you is that when we ask a question, you give us a truthful answer. And to sort of get the benefit of really cooperating, you have to not just answer our questions, but tell us what questions to ask. So schools do that in the way of pointing out, for instance, witnesses that the NCAA might be missing. And that's the kind of thing where a school can go from not just not getting hammered because they failed to cooperate, but actually getting the benefit of the doubt and maybe seeing a couple of those penalties reduced because they were so helpful to the NCAA that the NCAA sees an opportunity to send that message of not just don't make our lives hard or, you know, don't try to make the system not work, but, you know, work to make the system work even better.
Yeah, it seems to me like going back at least to back in 2006 with the Oklahoma Rhett Bomar scandal, it seems to me like, if I remember correctly how that went, the NCAA really took it pretty light on Oklahoma there, and that involved, I think, a lot of the school moving the compliance structure, I think, under the president's office. I could be wrong there, I'm not sure.
Yeah, those sort of things, when you do them, I think it's not so much the penalties there. I think things like that can you know, the problem with this delay is that a lot, like we saw with Oregon, a lot can happen between when the NCAA first gets wind of a violation and when the Committee on Infractions issues a decision. And there are all these things within, you know, that can happen over that period of time. Some of them that should affect the process, like how well the school helps the NCAA with their investigation, and some that shouldn't. So, you know, moving the compliance office, I think, well, I would say, you know, if this is supposed to be this kind of quasi-legal proceeding, it doesn't change the fact that the violations were committed. It doesn't change the fact that, you know, at the time, maybe that wasn't the right structure. I think, you know, it's such a message, you know, there's so many reading of the tea leaves in a Committee on Infractions report that if they dismiss a school's moves like that, then schools will not, you know, will stop doing things that the Committee on Infractions wants them to do, like, you know, make sure that compliance is not answering to the athletic director solely, or make sure that compliance is adequately staffed, or make sure that the head coaches are monitoring their programs effectively. So while, you know, I think people might look at that and say, you know, there is this kind of attitude of that the NCAA is sending this message that you can go break whatever rule you want as long as on the back end you say you're sorry and fall on your sword and you know, make a bunch of changes if you get caught. And I think what the NCAA needs to be careful with is to make sure that they're still sending that message of when you screw up, you know, we want this to be a corrective process, not just a punitive process. So we want you to acknowledge mistakes and fix them rather than just us simply, you know, throwing as many punishments at you as we can find. But at the same time, you don't want it to be a kind of cost of doing business, which gets you into that same risk reward and cost analysis that Mark Emmert and so many people in the NCAA have been railing against for the past few years.
See, every time people bring up the idea of instead of taking away some of these penalties, you know, like scholarships or bowl bans, and moving to monetary penalties, to me that's always the first thing that comes up, because, you know, you're essentially making cheating, you know, into kind of you know, a risk management type issue.
Well, and it becomes, you know, a have and have nots issue.
Yeah.
If Boise State can afford, you know, if Oregon can afford a $5 million fine, but Boise State can't, then Oregon has a built-in advantage. And, you know, we know Oregon has built-in advantages over, you know, other schools, and some schools have built-in advantages over Oregon. But I think the ability to simply ignore the rule book shouldn't be one of those. So, you know, as much as the scholarships, you know, and all of these penalties, people always look at them as punishing the wrong people. I think it is tough to get away from them because they work. I mean, coaches say that, you know, when I was at NACTA, I sat in a session with where Urban Meyer was talking about the new head coach responsibility rules. And he said there's two things that coaches feel, and that's bowl bans and scholarship losses, because they affect their ability to keep their jobs. Because if you get a bowl ban, you know team can't go to a bowl, you're getting fired. And if you suffer huge scholarship losses and the team isn't competitive, you're getting fired. And now the increased use of coaching suspensions is going to be another one. So I think that's a very significant development, those coaching suspensions, because that can really, you know, punish the people who were responsible for the violation, rather than punishing this, you know, it sort of seems like it always punishes innocent parties or the student athletes. And at the same time, you know, the NCAA is moving to a structure where it will be able to split out the cases into different levels. So perhaps, the school's responsibility in the violation is relatively low. You know, this really was a rogue program or a rogue coach, and we can, you know, dispose of it quickly and give relatively minor penalties to the school and then come back and throw the book at the coaching staff. And that, I think, will go a long way to sort of answering some of those criticisms that while these penalties are effective, because we see what happens to coaches when they get hit with these penalties, they do have these sort of collateral damage that needs to be limited if at all possible.
So I guess, you know, one of the questions I have still out of all this, I guess, would be, you know, you mentioned there's so much new stuff coming for the NCAA, so much restructuring going on, new ways of doing business. I mean, do you think that this is going to bring about a better system, or at least one that functions better?
I think it can, but I think we saw a major setback with the deregulation. So I think the changes in the enforcement program are good. You know, holding head coaches responsible, which, you know, is not just about, you know, suspending them when their assistants commit a violation, but is getting them to, you know, take the conduct of their assistants seriously is good. I think the expanded COI and the panel system and getting more perspectives on there, because it tends to largely be people with a compliance background and lawyers, that's good. I think hopefully we'll see that the processing of cases gets quicker as a result. There have been a lot of promises made there that so far haven't been met, but we'll see if the changes that are coming in August, you know, finally crack that nut. And I think the penalty matrix will hopefully go a long way to, if not, you know, making every case look the same to the public, will at least give, you know, the smarter people a chance to say, no, you know, this case that ended up in the same, you know, general group as the case you're complaining about, so the penalty should be the same. What I worry about is that whole system is predicated on not having it applied to 100 phone calls or a bunch of text messages.
Yeah.
Or, you know, a coach who sent, you know, accidentally sent a bunch of tweets to kids. It's not designed, and I think it's going to continue to get bogged down if we continue to have a bunch of rules that are relatively petty, take a lot of effort to monitor and to investigate when there are issues, and which have little benefit when it comes to competitiveness. I mean, you know, the number of phone calls a kid receives it doesn't make that big of a difference in recruiting. And if it does with one kid, if he really wants to get called 100 times a day by a bunch of different coaches, there's another equally talented kid who just wants to talk to a coach once in a while and just wants to be left alone and make his decision and then go to school. So I think if we continue to have this, then what we're going to see is a big caseload. Cases aren't going to get processed shorter. We're going to have so many cases in the system that it will be easy to pick apart the inconsistencies, and we're going to see stiffer penalties applied to conduct that I think a lot of people would agree is not deserving of that, you know, level of enforcement. So all of the things the NCAA is doing, you know, it all fits together. And same goes for the stipend. I mean, one of the things is, you know, if we're going to continue to enforce amateurism, then we need to cover the costs of college and not have this gap between the cost of attendance, especially if we're going to come in with stiffer penalties for those violations. So the fact that the membership has taken this kind of buffet approach where we like this little piece, but we don't like this, and we're going to fight against this, but we're going to, like, yield on this, you're just going to end up with a lot of the same problems, just kind of repackaged in a different way. So I don't know if you can kind of come out of this. I think this process of reform has gotten pretty bogged down right now. And what's coming down the pipe, it has a chance to sort of kick things into gear, but not in, you know, the most friendly and gentle way. It's going to be, you know, the big conferences now adding unlimited food for their athletes to stipends as an issue that they're going to threaten to leave Division I over. And that's really, I think, what we're going to see happen over the next couple of years is those grievances are going to build up, even if some of them, I think, are MacGuffins. They're really just, you know, something that the big schools are using to justify the threat of leaving. And either it will happen and they'll leave, or the smaller schools will sort of concede. And I think we'll find that it doesn't really affect competitiveness that much. You know, the same schools are going to win. The same schools are going to be able to, you know, bust the playoff or bust the BCS. And, you know, the search for money is always makes playoffs expand, and those always help the little guy, you know, more than mm-hmm. the big guys who already have access to the playoff. So I think, you know, we'll sort of see this kind of build up over the next couple of years. And hopefully, as much as, you know, the NCAA and the national office and Mark Emmert and the people that lead the governance structure through this reform effort get frustrated by the membership's reaction, they do have to kind of double down on the things that have already been passed. So they have to say, you know, we have to make this enforcement program work, even if it was designed to work with a different rule book. And they need to loudly and consistently try to pound that square peg into the round hole, because it helps the membership understand why this stuff isn't things you can take pieces of, and it helps the public understand where the problem is. That it's not with the national office or the NCAA, it's with the motivations of the member schools. And when that kind of public opinion shifts, we might see the member schools sort of more willing to go along with a reform effort that, you know, at least from my stance, is, you know, pretty long overdue.
John, does that qualify as a rant?
I don't know. I think I, you know, talked to as somebody described me, NPR-ish.
So that's about as much a rant as I think I've ever heard from you.
Yeah, I tend to, you know, reserve my – I try not to write angry about this stuff, because there's a lot of writing angry about the NCAA, and I think it comes off as, you know, somewhere between somebody just pounding on drywall and, you know, people who, you know, wearing tinfoil on their head yeah. to stop the satellites from reading their thoughts. So I do, you know, it's very frustrating to sort of sit here and see how that's bogged down, when I think, you know, especially some of the kind of compromises that have been offered are the impact of them is minimal. I mean, some of the stipend ideas that have been thrown out there would have cost schools virtually nothing. Mm-hmm. I mean, like rounding errors in how much extra money they would get. Even some of the smaller conferences, as TV contracts are renewed. I don't see that big financial, you know, it's the financial impact in some of the stuff. I don't see the big competitiveness impact. And, you know, I think schools are missing an opportunity to change the game and operate under a new set of rules, because under the current set of rules, you know, Nick Saban is destroying everybody. So why would you not want to change the rules and potentially have a chance to jump on that and be the first mover while, you know, Alabama and Oregon and USC and, you know, some of these other programs that have been, you know, strong over the last decade or so, try to make what they're doing right now work under a new set of rules. And instead, I think, you know, Alabama showed that they could jump on it as quickly as everyone else. And because of that one thing, you know, them hiring a bunch of recruiting staff, you now bogged down this whole process.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. I think that's a really good point. Well, John, you know, I love having you on, because every time I feel like I leave a lot smarter. So I thank you very much for that, and I really appreciate you taking time out to talk with us tonight about Oregon and where this is all going with the NCAA.
You're welcome. Yeah, anytime.
And thank you all, too, for joining us for CrystalBallRun.com. I'm Alan Kenny. Take it easy.